Welcome to Intelligence Squared, where great minds meet. I'm Head of Programming, Connor Boyle. On the episode today, Jason Okundaya, the writer whose essays and work has been published in titles such as the London Review of Books, The Guardian, British GQ, and more. He's here to discuss his first book, Revolutionary Acts, which explores the stories of black gay men in Britain. Joining Jason to talk about it is Tom Crewe. He's an editor at the London Review of Books and a novelist. His recent book, The New Life, won the 2023 Orwell Prize for Political Fiction. Let's join Tom now with more.
Hello and welcome. I'm speaking to Jason Okundaya. Jason was born to British Nigerian parents in South London in 1997. And we're here to talk about his debut book, Revolutionary Acts, Love and Brotherhood in Black Gay Britain. It's an oral history, I suppose, of seven black gay men talking about their experiences in life. And I hope, Jason, it's a compliment because it's meant as one when I say that it really feels like it's the first of many such books, certainly not the last. It feels like it's opening up so much wonderful territory to explore. There seems like there's still so much more work to be done, and I think it's a real achievement to have seen the subject lying there waiting for its historian. And it's actually a really fun book. It's chatty, it's conversational in both senses. It's full of conversations with you and your subjects, but you are conversational. You are a really lovely presence on the page, chatting with your friends as they have become. So I think that's a really lovely quality too. And I thought I would just ask, generally to begin with, all of these men live in Brixton. They didn't all necessarily start in Brixton, but Brixton is the uniting principle, if you like, that they have collected around, and most of their experiences are shaped by their time living in Brixton in South London. So I thought maybe you could just tell us a bit about Brixton, why it's important, why these men ended up there, and why, in a way, it's such a subject of your book.
Yeah, I mean, so I introduced the book talking about this guy called Ivor Cummings, who is this gay father of Windrush, who helped to resettle Windrush migrants into Clapham, who then migrated into Brixton. And I didn't start it because I had any more information on this man, but to kind of set up the fact that, you know, there are reasons why Brixton has been this particularly important space for Afro-Caribbean and African communities and their descendants, and why even, you know, decades after those Windrush arrivals, there has still been this attraction to Brixton as a space. And the way that we think about Brixton in our, you know, more popular understanding is that we think about the uprisings that have happened there. We think about things like police brutality. We might think about the Brixton nail bombings. And some people might have some knowledge of Brixton's queer history in terms of the South London Gay Liberation Front and the squatting movement that took place on Relton Road and Mail Road. But what I found was that there was such a rich black gay history in Brixton, and there were so many people who were still there as well. And I just felt like those narratives of black history and queer history weren't being reconciled, even though that there were people who not only, you know, straddled both, but literally were both and were present at moments relevant to queer communities, black queer communities. So, and also in writing this book, I just realized, you know, it would be really important for me to have a setting as well. I think sometimes with the form of nonfiction, there's this idea that, you know, nonfiction has to be quite, you know, broad and as general as possible. But I wanted to be more creative and say, you know what, I'm going to really orient this in a place in South London and have a really focused narrative and look at just how much a scene can thrive in a place which is sometimes associated with like aggression and masculinity and homophobia. Brixton was a very intentional choice for me. And as you said, you know, all of the men had lived there, either still lived there or have lived there for significant periods. And a lot of their organizing artistic activity would have been there as well.
Mm. One of the interesting things I think about the book, and it comes up a few times, I think, is this idea that some of your seven men moved there, as we say, but some of them grew up in the area. And there's an interesting tension actually between the people who came to the area fresh from another part of the country and the people that have grown up there surrounded by friends, family, neighbors. And actually there's a difference in the ability of these people to come out to live freely in the area, whether they're going to run into their grandmother or not on the street. And that's something that also impacts the relationship with the white gay community in Brixton, that again, they probably have come from somewhere else and can live that free life in the place that they grew up. And some of your subjects found that a little bit more difficult.
Yeah, so in Brixton, obviously, you had the South London Gay Liberation Front, which was mainly made up of white gay men and lesbians, and they would kind of, you know, put on these theatric productions in the streets and have big public demonstrations. But of course, if you're someone who is a black gay person within the community in Brixton, you know, you have your family there, you have your church there, you have friends there, and you might not be willing to commit yourself to come out in such a public way. You might feel safer going to an underground house party, which has like a certain knock or code to get admission. So it meant that there was this kind of distinction where you had the kind of more openly activist movement, which was bright, colourful and vivid, and you kind of like out and loud. And that was sometimes coming into tension with some of the black gay men who were of the area and wanted to express themselves, but perhaps felt more confined by the fact that they would have to do this right in front of their community. But that did also mean that for some of the black gay men who came from different parts of the country, so one of the men, Dennis Carney, came from Manchester. And the reason why is that, you know, he'd been living in Manchester all his life. And then he came down to Brixton and came to this one black gay house party. And then within a month, you know, moved down there because he was like, you know, this is where I need to live my life. He was able to go there and just be really open. Like on the back of his car, he used to have like black gay man number one written on the back. And he was able to just be really open and boisterous with it. And sometimes, you know, people say like, actually, that would rub people up the wrong way sometimes because they would think, well, you're able to have this freedom because you've come from Manchester, you don't have any family here, you know, the friends here are the friends you've made here as an openly gay man, but we can't do that because we've grown up in this place and we still feel constrained. So I was quite interested in Brixton as that kind of geography and like who gets to be open and out and loud in this context.
And I think that that feeds into something else, which is that several of your subjects eventually feel that they're not willing to give up on their community. They're not willing to go somewhere else or go to a private party, or in the end, they feel compelled to reconcile these two parts of their life, the gay part of their identity and the black part of their identity. And that becomes really the formative moment of their movement into life or into activism, is actually refusing to separate those things any longer.
Yeah, and I think that particularly in the activist sense, there were some of these movements. So in the book, I talk about this man, Alex Owolade, who was leading a lot of activism, which was, you know, loudly in conversation with straight black people and trying to say, you know, homophobia that plagues our communities is not too dissimilar from the racism which plagues all of us, and to show that there is an interconnectedness and solidarity between oppressed groups, and also that on the flip side, that institutions of oppression and bigotry are also going to work together as well. So what I really showed in these men is that these weren't men who found themselves exiled from the black community and then decided, well, you know, I'm just going to go to like the white gay community or something and, you know, live my life openly and proudly there. These were men who kind of said, you know what, we are open and proud black gay men, and we are also going to live as open and proud black gay men, and we are going to integrate ourselves and not be, you know, rejected from the black community. And I thought that was, you know, quite incredible and quite striking. And it was a determination which meant that, you know, people weren't just having secret house parties. They were also starting to go to the West End, start to take over clubs and start to basically build this like really first out generation of black gay nightlife and clubbing. So, and that's what I really wanted for this book. I didn't want this book to be about men who just found themselves a minority within the setting. I wanted to be about men who came together and found some strength in numbers and found that they were, you know, embracing all parts of their identity, but also reckoning with how that also can lead to tensions and conflicts as well, right? The thing about being a minority, being gay, being black, being both or whatever, is that sometimes you might come together with people under the guise of shared identity, but that doesn't always necessarily mean that you see eye to eye or you have this, you know, wholly positive experience. So I was just interested in what it means for people to come together under an activist label, under a kind of like social community setting, and what kind of stories could come out of that. And I was, you know, really pleased with the results.
And why did it feel important to you to capture that disagreement, the tensions, the falling out, the bitchiness? Why did that feel like a relevant or significant thing to try and grasp?
Because it's honest, right? And the history of any kind of like movement, institution or whatever will always have, you know, different factions and different wings and disagreements. And I didn't want to present any like singular black gay life or ideology, because, you know, what would the point of that be, right? If I'm writing a kind of oral history, everything is going to be coloured by each individual's interpretations, their political persuasions, their upbringing, which is why I talk about some of their upbringings, where it's relevant to kind of see how their upbringings might have shaped their politics. So someone like Alex Owolade grew up in Leicester and was very involved in the striking miners movement as well. So obviously he developed a very radical left-wing politics, which might have come into tension with someone who had a more like kind of like professional background and came into activism more kind of thinking about it as a kind of like diversity and inclusion strategy. So I really wanted to basically just get across the fact that, you know, not everyone gets along necessarily, not everyone has the same view, and that is just as important. It's important that the Black gay movement is presented as a broad church, not as, you know, one singular dominant view. I mean, even today, I don't agree with every Black gay person. Not every Black gay person agrees with me, and that's absolutely fine. Everyone has their own view, everyone has their own contribution and their own understanding of what it means to live this kind of life and what our lives should look like.
Yeah, I agree, and I think it's always a danger when one feels oneself to belong to a minority community, that we speak on behalf of the community or we represent the community. And that is often to lose, certainly to lose individuality, but also to kind of neutralize ourselves or make ourselves blander than we really are. That it's a much more interesting picture if you see people in their rich multiplicity, something much less patronizing about it. And actually, it's just to carry on from that point, there is something so lovely about the book in the sense it, just to go back to this idea of a conversation, there's a conversation not just between you and your subjects, but between your subjects themselves across the chapters of the book. Someone like Alex, who you just mentioned, is coming up all the time. Various figures will say, oh, Alex was doing that, I didn't like that point. And he sort of pops up over and over again. And lots of them have met each other at different points in their lives. And there's a great sense of generational progress as a cohort, though that doesn't imply coherence or agreement. This emphasis on place, we've talked about Brixton, but I do think that comes back to something which is truthful about the gay historical experience as a whole, because so much about being gay through time has been shaped by this need to escape the home, to escape neighbours, observers, to kind of get into a space where you are not known, where you are free from your social constraints or the social identity, possibly heterosexual identity you have in your day-to-day life. So gay life has often involved finding spaces, places for sex or sociability, and those places are often not really places at all. They're standing outside a public toilet or in the woods or by a roadside. And I think the paradox of legalization in 67 is that there's this great emphasis, let men do something in private. Will allow men to have sex in private. But actually, it continues to be the case that men need to go out and find people like them. And that actually involves leaving the home, leaving these private spaces, going out into the public. And it's a real theme of your book, actually, that so many of your subjects are trying to find spaces, places, venues to meet, to dance, to have sex. Did you expect that to be such a theme, this search for space? And did it in the end surprise you? Because I think it comes up in the book that actually, as you get into the 2000s, as we get into the internet age, that need for physical spaces, named places, has started to diminish.
I mean, it didn't surprise me in the sense that to be able to bring someone back to your house, you need to be able to meet them in public, right? But what I found quite striking was that it almost felt as if there was more opportunity for that kind of like in-person socializing, to go and like cruise someone and to like express that desire in a very physical sense outside in public, whether that's, you know, at nighttime or in the day, just crowding around a bunch of toilets. What was interesting about that was that I just felt like, you know what, there's actually a bit of a decline of this kind of socializing now. As you say, in the book, you know, there's a lot of mention of things like, you know, youth-focused spaces where people would come together for discussion. There are also cruising grounds outside the toilets. There are also, you know, big house parties where there's almost like a Black gay family there who are inviting young people to come together and be like, you know, you can come here, you can sleep with someone, you can meet people here. And I felt like what the things that have made this difficult now, the fact that, you know, cruising is, you know, more significantly policed, you know, the rise of like surveillance technologies means that, you know, the spaces where you can cruise are far more limited, and the consequences for it are also, you know, just as drastic as they were. And also, who's got a house now, right? Like, I remember speaking to Mark Thompson, who spoke about when he wanted to leave his family home, and he basically said that, oh yeah, I went down to the council and I got a flat, and I just thought, what? That is, and you were just able to live by yourself. And it's like, it was just such a casual thing to be able to just access housing back then. That's not to say that there weren't any difficulties for people, that there was no homelessness or there was no housing crisis, but there was just like a kind of ease and smoothness to be able to have your own space. Just, I found that quite fascinating because I thought, you know, I live with my mum at the moment because, you know, the private renting sector just got silly. So I wouldn't be able to put on a house party or bring someone back home in the same way that they might have been able to at my age. And even if someone wanted to be really enterprising and start like a nightclub or buy a bar or something or buy a pub, because of the pressures of the housing market, people are sinking that money into a deposit now. You know, you don't, mm-hmm. there isn't the same kind of like access and resources. And I think that that is such a shame. It was very interesting to therefore think about the way in which, well, I didn't approach this thinking like, oh, everything was so much worse back in the day, so let's look at how things have progressed. I just wanted to know, you know, how were things? And whilst there, you know, there might be progress in terms of, you know, like, I don't know, like HIV technologies and AIDS and things like that, there have also been like significant backslides in terms of like socialization and just being able to meet people and being able to afford the spaces that we have. So I basically kind of, you know, wrote those things into the book because I really wanted to show that, you know, we can actually take community and scenes and things for granted, and the arc of history isn't always, you know, going up and up and positive. Things can get worse, and unfortunately they are.
Yeah.
Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents with the code squared. Simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code squared to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV. The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed. So you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
Talking about trying not wanting to erase difference, I think it's also really important that we don't see progress as this straight line, this sort of arrow to the future. I mean, the whole of certainly of gay history is actually of peaks and troughs. And I always like to remind people that the kind of worst time to be gay in terms of police arrests and police harassment was in the 1950s. Long after the kind of what people might think of as the dark days of Oscar Wilde and so on. That actually makes me think about politics. I mean, and one of the things, talking of places, so often your subjects are searching for places to kind of put political organizations in or social organizations which have a political edge. And it's something interesting about being born gay or realizing that you're gay is that the state is intimately involved with sexuality. Certainly before legalization, there was this emphasis on children, marriage. The state is invested in the heterosexual family unit. So I think for a long time, there is a sense that to be gay is to be brought into tension with this state relationship between sex and politics, but also to be born black into an institutionally racist country like Britain is also to be potentially born into a political relationship, into a political tension with the state and the country you inhabit. And so I wondered whether it seems almost inevitable that your men, your seven men, are all in various ways politicized, are brought into forms of political activity, even if they are informal. And I wondered whether you felt it was impossible to be a black gay man and be apolitical, whether that has produced a burden for your seven men, whether that was felt as a kind of difficulty and there was ever a wish just to live a different kind of life, or whether really the story is one of being energized and forced into forms of experience and activity that they wouldn't have done otherwise. Is it a kind of either or is it a happy thing? I don't know. I don't really know what I'm asking, but I'm sure you'll have an interesting answer.
I get what you're saying, and it's a difficult one to call because, you know, not everyone leads a political life or not everyone thinks that they're leading a political life. But even when someone, you know, might only see themselves as socially involved in the black gay scene, they are inevitably impacted by, you know, certain political considerations. If you're someone who particularly enjoys going to a nightclub, you might want to consider the fact that, you know, institutional racism means that, you know, Western clubs might turn away black patrons or not want to, you know, license premises to black people. And that might mean that you might have like a white club promoter to go and, you know, license the premises on your behalf. And then that leads to certain political and financial power relationships between you as, you know, black clientele or black DJs or black culture makers and this white person who effectively owns you and kind of like can take, you know, so much of your profit. So it means that anyone who kind of wants to be involved in the black gay scene inevitably is politicized in some kind of way, you know, even if they think they're not. Someone like a 17-year-old Mark Thompson, who was diagnosed HIV positive at the age of 17, is inevitably immediately politicized or at least becomes relevant as a political entity. He can't just ignore, you know, what the government is doing in terms of their strategy on HIV. He can't ignore, you know, the Department of Health. He suddenly has to be so hyper aware of, you know, all of these different things. So it's almost impossible to think of anybody in like who was black and gay openly in the 1980s, 90s, who was able to kind of opt out of politics. And that doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, they watch Prime Minister's Questions or they're really kind of like involved in some kind of like, you know, parliamentary or like really official big wig political discourse, but they are thinking about, you know, their lives, the lives of their friends and surviving as well. And I think that a lot of the men speak about this real fixation on surviving. DJ Biggie C talks about the fact that he became really fixated on the millennium, thinking, you know, am I going to actually live until then? If that's not because of, you know, HIV or AIDS, if I was to contract it, that might also be because the conditions in this country might be so severe that they might cause me to take my life. The book ends with, you know, the story of a man who has taken his life because, you know, life had become so difficult for him. And whilst, of course, that's tied up in personal struggles and can't purely be deduced as because of the political climate, those things are also not incidental to the fact that life becomes difficult for men in this country. I mean, there was something that I actually didn't explore in the book because I just felt like it was, you know, it was quite, it was sensitive, but also it was something that, you know, wasn't as much my story to tell. And this doesn't pertain to any of the men in this book, but there was also, you know, a big crisis in terms of drug use, in terms of crack, and people just, you know, being so beaten down by the homophobia and bigotry and racism as well, that they were finding themselves turning to, you know, really extreme substances to be able to keep going. And then that also, if you're then in Brixton, which is a place which is incredibly over-policed, and you're a black gay person who is on crack, imagine the implications of that in terms of like your exposures to violence, in terms of like your dependence on dealers and all of these kind of power relations which happen. So broadly speaking, yeah, I don't personally think like politics is something anyone can opt out of. I mean, you can be kind of like the most airy-fairy person, doesn't really think critically or anything like that, and that's fine. Everyone has the right to do that. Those people seem very happy. But if you are a black gay person in the 1980s, even now, I think you are always burdened with some thought of, you know, what are the risks to my life? And, you know, if I wake up today, what kind of news am I greeting about people who are like me? So yeah, that's my view on that, I guess. I don't know if that answers the question.
No, it does. It completely answers. No, it's exactly the kind of thing I was trying to articulate. And I suppose you yourself are engaged in what can be seen as a political initiative. I mean, this, you talk about recording this Black History as a or recording Black history as sometimes feeling like a rescue effort, a race against time. And, you know, I think this book is a political act. It's a determination to claim something and memorialize something that the state and other institutions have not been sufficiently interested in. Does it feel like that to you?
It definitely feels like that to me. And that's because, you know what, when I was doing my like preliminary research and trying to find, okay, where can I look for these, you know, Black gay materials of the past? And I was going to, you know, certain archives and institutions and I was just finding nothing. And the place that ended up being most fruitful was the Rutgers Archive at the London Metropolitan Archives. And the reason why that is so fruitful is because Tova Campbell and Ajamu X said, we're going to create a Black gay archive because no one else is going to do this. And, you know, I think they created that in, might be wrong on the date, but in the early 2000s. And even since then, these other archives and institutions still don't have, you know, their own kind of like specific Black gay records. Even when I went to, there was the kind of like first gay museum which opened up in King's Cross. Is it called the Gay Museum? I actually can't even completely remember right now. And this isn't even to like call them out, but I remember visiting it and just thinking there just isn't much by way of like Black gay history here at all. And it's like, you know, they can consult someone to, you know, find these materials. It's not like these materials don't exist. They can consult people to try and, you know, get more of it. But ultimately it ends up being up to us to kind of like fill in the gaps, you know, recover this history. And quite literally before it dies. And do you know what? The urgency of that was actually really spelled out to me whilst I was researching. So when I was trying to like come up with my list of contributors and people I wanted to speak to, you know, it was quite a fine process. You know, there were some people I contacted who just didn't want to be involved, which is, you know, totally fine. But there was also a man in contact, and like for privacy's sake, I won't like give any revealing details about who he was. But I was really interested in contacting him because he had a lot to say about fashion, and I'm very into fashion, so I thought, oh, this is, you know, brilliant. Like he would be able to say so much. But no one had contact with him actually. No one had seen him in years. They hadn't heard. They weren't even sure. They couldn't confirm if he was alive or not, basically. And it was really strange. So I'd seen photos of him from like 1990, and I remember I was walking home from the gym, and I just saw a man with a walking stick just walking along really slowly, and I stood there for 5 minutes just staring at him. And I was like, you know, I came up to him and he was like, I was like, are you this person? He was just like, kind of like, what the hell? How do you know who I am? And I basically just explained who I was. I gave him names of people that I knew that he knew. And I started to like contact him, chat to him. The man was very, very unwell. There was no ethical way that I was going to, you know, go and sit this man down and like get an interview out of it. It would have been completely perverse and wrong. And I don't think someone in that mental state would be able to consent to having their story out there. But I also found like a really old documentary tape. People had spoken about the fact that this guy had been in this old documentary and they said, oh, we just remember this. So I had the vaguest bit of information and I was trawling online for ages until I found a singular record for the BFI archives and I was able to watch the documentary tape on the premises and that's it. And he had been talking about his career in fashion on this documentary tape and was, you know, very open about his sexuality on the tape as well. And I just thought, you know, this is possibly the only like record that we have of this guy, of the, you know, incredible work that he was doing. And also this guy is not in a position now where he's able to speak for himself because he's so unwell. And I just thought, you know, if I had been able to find this guy 10 years ago, perhaps I could have learned so many incredible things about what he did with his life. And I would have been able to, you know, bring that to, you know, interested readers who could learn about what it meant to be, you know, a Black gay man working fashion back in the 1980s. But that opportunity is lost. And I don't know for how long he might remain. But I still chat to him. I still have a relationship with him. I have not kept the relationship with him thinking, okay, if he recovers, great. I can, you know, go and write part two. But it just felt like, actually, you know, people not be able to speak for themselves when they are not in the mental state to, or when they are dead. And I also had this dilemma also when there was a guy in my book called Webster who was a friend of Mark Thompson's who died very young. And I kind of felt conflicted about whether or not I should name him in the book because, you know, he had died supposedly of cancer and was the victim of, you know, these horrendous homophobic racist arson attacks whilst he was, you know, a cancer patient but living at home. And then I found literally just by chance, I was looking at the voice archives in the British Library and I wasn't even looking for anything to do with him. I was looking for something completely unrelated. And then I just saw this front page picture of him, of this cancer patient. I was like, oh my God, this is the guy who Marker told me about. Okay, good thing I came here and, you know, requested these, this specific year as well, of the catalogue. And in that, he basically, he was dying and he had said that he wants to write about his life. He doesn't want his story to die with him. And then I remember thinking, I needed to read this actually, because yes, I do need to write this guy's name. He didn't want his story to die. He was someone who had planned to write a book on his life. And so what I then did was that he had a partner who was also called Mark, but a different Mark, gets a bit confusing in the book, who I spoke to, who I just said, you know, tell me about Webster, please. Tell me about your relationship, what he was like, what he did, because, you know what, I'm writing this book and this is someone who did not want to just be forgotten. So yeah, there's so much contestation with, you know, remembering people and getting people to actually go and be able to tell their stories. And there is also that kind of tension about, you know, telling people's stories posthumously too. But yeah, I've actually forgotten the question, so I've kind of just gone on. But I don't know if that answers it.
No, it was talking about, it was all relevant. It was talking about how we remember and how that your book is a political act of remembrance, yeah, of claiming the past before, because other people won't.
Yeah, and I think,
and I, yeah, for me, I'm just going to say, I hope your book will prompt people to come forward, and I hope it has that kind of effect.
There's so much more. I honestly just feel like what I even have written and what I've explored is just like a small fraction of everything that I'm going to know and continue exploring about the past as well. I just find the past and history just so incredibly abundant, and just having these memories and recollections from just seven men, which have, you know, totaled up to a book, I just think shows that, you know, even just conversations with anyone can lead to like new tidbits of information and new insights into what it has been like, and things can inform, you know, the institutions and the movements that we have today. So yeah, my view of the past has definitely been like changed and shaped forever by looking at and really kind of really centering the voices of those who lived through it, basically.
Well, that's all we have time for. Thank you very much, Jason Okandyer, for talking to me on the Intelligence Squared podcast. And I really recommend Jason's book, Revolutionary Acts, which gives you a real sense of what it must have been like to be Jason and to be uncovering these stories and meeting these men. They're a wonderful bunch, and you do feel like you know them too by the end, or would like to get to know them. So thank you very much, and goodbye.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Intelligence Squared. This episode was produced by Leila Ishmael and edited by Tom Hall. If you want to keep up with everything going on at Intelligence Squared, sign up to the newsletter. Head over to intelligencesquared.com to get the heads up on all our live events coming up. And members can also peruse over 20 years of our back catalogue featuring some of the world's great minds. That's all over at intelligencesquared.com.